Okay, welcome to Not the Wikipedia Weekly. My name is Eric. I go by the username Skartle on the English Wikipedia, and we are joined here on the call by user Moni3.
Hi there.
We have user Yellow Submarine, who signs as Maria.
Hello.
We have Awadawit, who signs as Awadawit.
Hello.
And we have user Phil with three L's.
How do you do?
We are hosting, and yeah, we're hosting this podcast about copy editing. Awadawit and I sort of came up with it because we figure there's a lot of stuff that should be said about copy editing, what it is, why it's important, and how to do it well. So we've sort of snuck into the Not the Wikipedia Weekly guys in order to have a discussion about all this stuff. Let's start with the basics. What is copy editing?
So, do we think it's made up of several different elements, like
Well,
fixing small? Yeah, go ahead.
my theory was that it's two main elements. One of them is adhering to the manual of style, and the other is a little bit more nebulous. It's the flow and the syntax of the words and how they're used, and if it's interesting, if it's compelling, or if they're not and they're really boring.
There's a book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud, which is a really interesting look at art and everything. And he talks about the process of creating art, and he talks about the six steps. And the core of the artwork is sort of like the seed of the apple, you know. And as you get away further from the seed, you end up with sort of the matters of polish and the glossy elements. And I think that's really for me where copy editing is. You know, if the writing element and the research is sort of at the core of the work, then when you get further toward the outside and you get further along in the process, that's where you get into copy editing. So it's not so much about resources or about research, but it's about the nuts and bolts types things, the fixing up the way it looks and sounds and all that stuff.
Polishing.
Polishing.
So I think part of it is really artistic, right? Making it get that sort of brilliant prose idea, making it sound like it was written by someone who is a real writer, a real author, and that's when you have to start worrying about did I select the best word that I could have chosen. To reflect every single idea that I want to say, you know, is the diction that I've used in this article the most precise? And the other side of it is mechanical. Did I make any grammar errors, for example? And have I used the proper wiki code to make it appear on the screen, for example?
Yeah. And when we talk about that artistic element, you know, this is sort of one of the criteria for featured article, brilliant prose, as it says. You know, I think there in some cases there's a disagreement about what brilliant prose is. That is to say, you know, in some cases people think it should be as simple as possible, as uncomplicated as possible. And other folks will say, you know, in certain instances you need to have the fancier word. You need to have something that's a little more precise, even if that means that it's sort of a $10 word rather than a 50-cent word. Moni, did you want to talk about compelling prose?
Well, I think that there's compelling prose is a huge element of a featured article where I can read an article on a topic that I'm interested in and not understand quite what the author is trying to get across, and it really is either confusing or I start to drift, and I'd rather click on blue links than read further in the article. Or I can start reading an article or thought I that I never had any kind of interest in, and then become so engrossed in it that, you know, it's completely moving. And I remember something that happened to me, something an article I read was Emily Dickinson's actually, which Maria wrote, and by the end of her biography, I was completely immersed in this article and right along with Emily Dickinson. And that is what compelling prose is. And I've read others that I just drift away, and I just kind of, you know, I feel like I'm ADD, and these, you know, it's something about the prose, and I think it's a movement in the words. And if they're choppy, then they don't connect well, and then they don't really express what's trying to be said.
Awadawit, did you want to say something about the need for having that in science articles?
Yeah, I think another element of compelling prose is accessibility, which means that a general audience can read the article and understand the main points that are being made. And this is particularly important, I feel, in the science articles, where it's very easy to fall into scientific jargon and you end up having to click on every link to understand what the article is trying to say. And sometimes that's extremely difficult for people who aren't familiar with the jargon. You just get tired of the clicking and you just give up and you don't read. So a lot of times, actually, I try to review science articles on topics that I don't know anything about, and I write what I think the paragraph says in my own sort of humanities lay speak. And I say, well, this is what I got out of the paragraph. And sometimes it's kind of frightening to the sciences because they're like, oh my God. But
I
you know,
think
it's good practice. And I actually really welcome having scientists read articles that I've written about humanities topics because a lot of times I fall into the jargon of my own field, literary criticism, and I don't realize I'm doing it just because I use those words all the time.
No doubt. I think this is something that comes up a lot in like technology stuff, but it's true across the board, is that it's very hard for us to remember what it's like for people who haven't been through the processes that we've been through. So we have our trouble, and I think it's really important for people who are writing, and especially for people who are, gonna help make the writing better, to think about what are our assumptions, and to try to challenge your assumptions and think, okay, if a person has just sort of a basic knowledge about the world, but they don't have any specific knowledge about, Honoré de Balzac or the Everglades or whatever it is, what do we need to orient them with in order to let them enter this world that they're reading about? And I think that's where we come back to the part that Moni was talking about what, can you give me something that I can grab about Emily Dickinson and really want to keep going with it? And that, I think, is what is, really engaging for me.
Yeah, I agree with that. An article where actually I wouldn't be particularly interested in the topic, the writing can draw me into it, or the writing can push me away from it. Yeah.
Maria, did you have a comment, or did I hear just background noise?
So yeah, the accessibility issue and the fact that it reaches across different fields, just people don't understand because it gets so close to the subject material as well, whether or not it's their thing. And I had that issue reading film articles. And you would think that film articles would be accessible to everybody, but it depends what the film's about. It depends how the film was made, where it was made, who these people are. People just throw out terms or persons, and they expect, because they know who they are, that the reader would know who they are. And even though they include a blue link, they think that saying a person blue link, that's enough, but really it's not. And I think it's something as simple as just giving some kind of an introduction to something. And that's something that when I do copy edit, I say, who is this person? When did this happen? Where? And something as simple as that can really help improve an article.
Yeah, no doubt. Moni?
Well, one of the things I did when I read, excuse me, when I wrote the five articles on the Everglades is that I did quite a few Google searches on information, and what I found kept coming up over and over and over again. I tended to put at the top of the articles so that people who generally knew a little bit about the Everglades would read in the lead, yes, I'm familiar with that, and then they could go deeper into the subject in more detail. And then one of those things was everybody's heard of the Everglades being the River of Grass, Marjory Stoneman Douglas described in 1947. So that ended up being at the top of almost every lead. So people could grasp onto that and say, well, I've heard of that, I'm familiar with that. And then they can go deeper into more detail that's more scientific, that describes that, or even in some cases dispels that.
Sure. And I think in terms of, one's closeness to the material, I think that has a direct connection to copy editing as well, because the more you work on something, the more you fall back on your own assumptions, the more familiar you are with the way it sounds, and the more you feel like you don't need to explain stuff from a more objective standpoint. And so when you're working on an article, you do that sort of thing over and over again. It's very important to get some distance between that. So when we start talking about ways to get better at copy editing, I think that's one of the things we'll see is that a lot of people will tell you the best way to get ideas about, improving your copy editing is that, yeah, you get fresh eyes on it, you get some distance, you give yourself a break, and you try to find a way to disconnect your mind from the track that it's been on in terms of looking at it in a fresh way. What about you? You had something to say about sports and copy editing?
Well,
or accessibility.
I was going to say this. It's another topic that often is written about in a very narrow way. And I had read a couple of articles on professional wrestling and baseball that were written again with a sort of jargony tone. And I mentioned this to the editors, and they dramatically improved this. And I think it had just not occurred to them that it was written in such a narrow sort of almost like in universe way when you think about it with such jargon. But yeah, I mean, I think what we're talking about is it's really important to have people who are not so close to the topic or haven't spent so much time on the particular article read and copy edit the article. I mean, even just give advice, even if they aren't copy edit, saying, I don't understand this section or that sort of thing.
Yeah. And if I could just jump in real quick, one of the things I think is important for us to recognize when we're working on articles for Wikipedia is that we invest a lot of time and energy into this. And in some ways, I mean, you know, speaking personally, I do get a certain, you know, what's called ego stroking or whatever you want to call it, you know, satisfaction from having my contributions recognized. But I think it's also important for editors on Wikipedia and people who write in general to realize that you have to let go of that. And that if you really, you know, the choice has to be, do you want the article to be the best it can be, or do you want to have your contributions recognized and, you know, fawned over? Because if you're going for the quality of the work, you have to be able to say, okay, I need someone else to comment on this, and I need to take their comment seriously. I've had a couple situations, not many, but there have been a few, where people have asked me to comment on an article, and I'll give some comments, and they'll say, oh, well, the reason I'm not going to change that is X, Y, and Z, and the reason this other thing doesn't matter is X, Y, and Z. And it's ridiculous to have that attitude if you're going to really seek someone else's opinion. So I don't know. Maybe that can lead us into a segue about why copy editing is important in the first place. I mean, why should we bother with all these grammatical rules and you know, sweating over readability and things like that?
Yeah, why should we worry about grammar? What do you guys think?
Well,
I know that I correct a lot of grammar mistakes on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I read something.
Oh, wait, Phil?
And I think, gee, this isn't quite English. This kind of grates on me. Or even worse, I read it and I say, boy, I can't understand this at all. I don't even understand what they meant. So it's bad enough if it grates, but if I can't understand it, it really isn't doing the reader any service. So I quite often will note, I'll try to edit them if I can. If I can't, I will just copy the sentence to the talk page and ask what they meant and say that I couldn't understand it. Sometimes that isn't always taken in the same kind of spirit in which I offered the advice. They're not always very happy when I do that. But
and especially when it's unsolicited, sometimes people just have, you know, sensitive nerves and they feel like they're being attacked or something. So I think it's useful to approach it tactfully. But on the other hand, I think, yeah, it comes back to this question about so forth and so on. Moni had a thought about why we should bother?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, there's always as much time as people spend and research and effort and, you know, money even, that they spend on the research that they do to put into a Wikipedia article. There's a lot of emotion invested in this, and there comes a point, though, where you have to decide what is going to be best for the article, what's going to be best for the subject even. And I'm fond of saying that you have to, if you spend all that time, you have to honor your subject, which means you have to give it up. It means you have to give up the ownership of the article for the betterment of the article, which means people have to tinker with it and they have to criticize it. And all the time and effort that you spent, people are, you know, copy editors or peer reviews, they're going to have to say, you're going to have to change it because all these wonderful things you thought you put in there aren't as wonderful as you thought you had in there. So in that case, you kind of have to give it up after a certain step.
Yeah. A lot of it?
I mean, I think in general what we're talking about is, are you getting across the ideas you thought you were getting across to the reader? I mean, that's what Phil was talking about when he leaves notes on people's pages. I didn't understand what you were saying. And, you know, that's what Money was talking about when she's saying you have to offer it to, you know, peer reviewers and say, well, what do you think? You know, what am I saying here? Did you get what I'm saying? You know, did you get the wonderfulness of the topic, right? And I think that's the first reason we really have to pay attention to things like grammar and the organization of sentences and paragraphs is, can the reader understand what we're saying? And actually, that's a lot of the rules of grammar are about that. So, for example, if your pronouns don't refer back to actual you know, clear subjects, the reader's not going to be able to understand what you're talking about. That would be one example. And I think another reason we have to focus so carefully on writing and things like grammar is because it makes Wikipedia look more respectable. It makes it look like a legitimate reference source. I mean, if you go to an article that's has sentence fragments everywhere and grammar mistakes and no punctuation and no capitalization, people are going to look at it and go, well, why should I listen to this? Is clearly written by someone who has no idea what they're doing. I mean, good writing lends legitimacy.
Yeah, it's like wearing a tie if you go for a job interview or something. Like you may know what you're talking about even if you're not wearing a tie, but it gives you that, yeah, sort of air of respectability at the first step. You know, Moni mentioned the question about, you know, what will be best for the article, and I think it's particularly tricky on Wikipedia because especially if, you know, one takes, as many of us do, a subject and then we sort of go into it and we do, you know, weeks and weeks of research on it, or months even sometimes. We come to feel like we really know about what's best for the article, and in many cases we do, which is to say, you know, if some random IP editor comes along and says, you know, oh, you know, this sentence is stupid or this doesn't make sense or nobody cares about that, we feel like, you know, hey, look, I've spent a lot of time researching this. I feel like I'm more of an authority than this random, you know, could be some 13-year-old kid, you know, who doesn't know anything about the topic. And so it's important, I think, it's tricky because you don't want to give up all of your legitimacy as, you know, sort of an amateur expert, if you will, somebody who spent a lot of time researching something. But when it comes to copy editing, of course, you know, it's about more stepping back, and we aren't as, I think, personally invested in it. But I think it is recognizing that there is a specific difficulty, I think, with getting that distance and trying to understand what's best for the article on Wikipedia, because we have so many different voices with so many different levels of expertise weighing in on things that they may be right about, but that, yeah, it can be a little trickier next time. Moni, did you have something you wanted to comment on that?
I believe it was Awadawit that was saying that respectability is something that needs to that Wikipedia needs to concentrate on, because number one, it's really popular. It's a really popular site. It's one of the most popular sites on the internet. So it, of course, it gets a lot of criticism. But you know, I think it was Phil talking about, you know, a tie is more respectable. We're talking about, you know, copy editing in articles. You're talking about wearing clothes in front of people, not just a tie. So because it's so popular, because it's so so visited by so many people, then it's also quite a
I was just
target
going to
for
note,
as much criticism as
when
possible.
most people know
Yeah.
me, know that I'm quite
Moni?
active in
Excuse me,
some of the
Phil.
more controversial parts of Wikipedia, which have a slightly different character than the more general articles. There's a tiny, tiny fraction of articles which are quite controversial in political areas or in religion and other unusual areas. And I have noticed in many of those areas when some of your fellow editors have a very strong bias in some direction or other, they seem to misunderstand even the plainest prose almost on purpose, or it appears to be on purpose. It might be inadvertent. And it's very, very difficult to actually come to some sort of resolution on how this should be described properly, because they don't actually want it to say what you're intending it to say. They're aiming for something else, and they'll just say, well, this isn't clear. But it's not that it's not clear, it's that they have something else in mind, really, and using that just as kind of a straw man to attack the article, because they really want it to present their own personal point of view. And so I'll notice that
Yeah.
it's copy editing in those circumstances can be quite different than copy editing in a
Right.
normal article.
Yeah, Maria, you were talking about topics.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that some articles receive more picky copy editors, and I don't know if it's because of the subject matter or if it's because the copy editors who would be attracted to that kind of subject in the first place. If you look at Mary Wollstonecraft, then of course, she's Mary Wollstonecraft. She needs to have the most brilliant prose possible to, in order to, show how awesome she is. Whereas, my first featured article was about a baby polar bear.
Hey, he was
And
pretty awesome.
he's pretty awesome,
Yeah.
but didn't receive as much as academia sort of centered reviews as something more literary or
Right.
more high-end, you would think.
Yeah.
So I think, and I don't think it would be prejudice. It's just that the certain amount of attention that certain articles would receive.
Sure. Yeah, no doubt. I would say that in terms of when we have that sort of copy editing going on, and it's not directly related to that, but I think it's important for us to recognize that there is a balance that needs to be achieved between accepting advice from other people and standing firm with what we believe. And this is really getting into some of the more broad scale stuff, not so much about copy editing. But when we talk about the artistic elements of copy editing and what makes engaging prose, I think it's valid for us to say, there is a place for, this phrasing that I've got because I think, it helps the reader with X, Y, and Z. But I think there has to be that balance there between recognizing that what you think is valid has a reason, and if we can say, okay, this is why I think it should stay, it doesn't necessarily have to be an edit war so much as it is an actual discussion, yeah, finding that balance. Anyway, Awadawit, you wanted to talk about writing in different topics. Go ahead.
Yeah, I actually think it's really interesting that there's a much higher bar for the kind of brilliant prose that's supposed to appear in, say, literary articles. For some reason, if you're writing about a literary topic, you yourself are supposed to be a brilliant writer. I've never really quite understood that. That somehow, like by osmosis, I am supposed to be as brilliant a writer as Mary Wollstonecraft, just
How would
because
she
I
write the
study her.
Wikipedia page about
Right,
herself?
exactly. I actually think that articles on baby polar bear should be written just as well as articles on Mary
Just couldn't
Wollstonecraft.
be
The writing on
quite.
Wikipedia should be fabulous everywhere.
And I'll say it is on Newt. It's a pretty fabulous article.
It's a good article. But I actually the idea that some articles should be written better than others because of their topic, I've always had a sort of a problem with that. Just like the idea that some articles should be illustrated better because they're about, say, a painting. We should have great images in every article. We should strive to have quality images everywhere. So, I really think that we shouldn't differentiate really in that way. We should have a high bar.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all agree with that. Let's talk about some common mistakes that we see when we are doing copy editing or we see articles being discussed.
Yeah, let me weigh
Um,
in.
somebody want to start
One of the
with
most
some
common
specific
I
examples
find,
or
and the
things that you
most
see in
irritating I
general?
find, is run-on sentences. So these seem to be
Go ahead.
sentences where maybe a whole paragraph, and it might be 50, 60 word long sentences appear in one paragraph is one sentence, a very, very long sentence with a whole bunch of ideas or phrases strung together with a variety of commas or semicolons and colons, kind of indiscriminately, and sometimes with parentheses. Sometimes I've seen nested parentheses with parentheses inside parentheses with side thoughts to them, where maybe they should have been thinking about maybe where a footnote might be appropriate or something if they want some kind of an aside on something. Instead, they'll make nested parentheses two or three deep, which could be, well, it's just not very good writing, I don't think. It's certainly frustrating to try to read it. And that's probably the most common thing I find, is people who just don't want to end a sentence. They just can't bear to have something 10 words long, put a period, and then start a new sentence. They just have to jam as many thoughts together in one long, long, long sentence. I think that's probably my main complaint.
Absolutely. It's a big problem, and as an English teacher at a high school, I definitely see that a lot. I think the number one thing I can say to, number one thing I say to my students, and the number one thing I'll say to all the dedicated fans out there, is that it's important to have a variety of sentence lengths, and just because a sentence is long does not necessarily mean that it's well constructed. So, you know, the thing to look at is this. If you have a complete thought, that's a sentence. And you shouldn't string together two complete thoughts just for the sake of stringing them together. Now, having said that, a semicolon can be used to join two things that otherwise would be two sentences, but you have to do it right. And how do you get better at doing it right? Well, you know, Tony has some things is useful. Reading articles out loud is very helpful. There are a lot of ways to get better at it, but I think the key thing to remember is when you get done with one thought, finish your sentence and go on to another one. And if you decide later on that it's much easier to take sentences that are choppy and combine them than it is to take some that are running on and on and on and separate them, because first you have to go through and figure out what the thoughts are and then you have to separate them. So yeah. Also, in terms of the comma splice, which is what you were talking about there with sentences that go on and don't seem to end, a lot of times people will take two independent thoughts and join them together with just a comma. Well, a comma is not enough. It needs to be a semicolon or a comma and a coordinating conjunction like and, but, yet, so, or one of those. Okay. Let's see. Moni had something she wanted to say.
Yeah, one of the more common comments that I make for first or second featured article candidates is that many times their paragraphs really don't have any topic sentences. And especially for people who are reading this who are completely unfamiliar with the topic about what to expect or what kind of point that it is you're trying to get across, that not only topic sentences for paragraphs, but topic sentences for entire sections are extraordinarily helpful, and they make the article more cohesive, and they help with that brilliance. They help with that compelling writing so that people are able to understand it a lot better and are able to ease into information that they're unfamiliar with a lot more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What about it?
I guess one of my pet peeves is this at the beginning of paragraphs, because this is a vague pronoun that you have no idea what it's referring back to.
Can you give us an example of when someone might use that?
You can use it in sentences that refer clearly back to a noun at the end of the previous sentence, or in the middle of a sentence that refers back to a noun clearly in the middle of the sentence. But to use it at the beginning of a paragraph, it's not clear what it's referring back to. It can refer back to the entire idea of the previous paragraph. It can refer back to the last noun of the previous paragraph. It can refer back to the last idea of the paragraph. So it's really unclear when you start a paragraph, this, mm-hmm. without, you know, so, I mean, you can solve the problem by saying, by putting a noun after this, but then, of course, it's redundant. Why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. So you don't even need the this at all,
right.
Which Absolutely. Leads into the problem about redundancy, which is a huge problem on Wikipedia wordiness. Mm-hmm. People have very wordy writing. It's a problem I have that I struggle with all the time myself. Mm-hmm. And you just add in words as you're trying to describe something that yeah. you don't really need. So when you say that, for example, someone is you know, a youthful 13 years old. Do you really need to say that they're youthful when they're right. you're saying that they're 13? That sort yeah. of thing. Yeah. yeah. I mean,
there was some style guide I saw one time that said, you know, or some editor I saw interviewed who said that the best way to improve your writing is to sit down and seriously consider cutting out every other word, because we tend to use a lot of words that we don't need to use. And so the more we can work on being concise and really asking ourselves, if we're doing a copy edit or if we're reviewing our own work, to sit down and ask ourselves, okay, do we need this word? I mean, I think this is one of the things that, as much as people hate him for, Tony is really good at pointing out, is that, you know, look, these words aren't necessary. And if they're not necessary, then the question is, do they add something significant? Because not every word, obviously, is going to be necessary. There are some things you want to say in a way that's engaging, that's not necessary, but that it's, you know, it's useful in some other way. The question then is, that bar needs to be really high, and we need to be really careful about what it is that you do. What does that word do? What is it adding to the sentence? What is it asking, or what is it accenting in terms of our understanding of the subject or whatever? It is.
I think this is particularly true for adjectives and adverbs.
Mm-hmm.
You have to ask yourself every time you add an adjective and an adverb, do I have to have this?
Yes. Stephen King, in his book on writing, has a great bit about how he used to read pulp science fiction writers, and one in particular who kept describing things as being done zestfully, and how ridiculous it is that you have these descriptions, because adverbs in general tend not to add a whole lot. If you're looking at how to write creatively well, they say that adverbs generally should be avoided as much as possible, because you can usually describe the verb better, you can describe, the context better in a way that you don't have to say he slammed the door aggressively. Well, how else can you slam a door? Or, the
You
word,
have
the
a
fact that,
stronger verb in that
right, exactly.
instance.
You pick a stronger verb, you don't need an adverb there. So, Maria, what is this about the English major's curse?
Yes, I was thinking that something that people do a lot when they repeat themselves over and over and over again, and I liken that to somebody who's writing their paper and they're running out of time to finish it and turn it in, and so they just repeat one major thing several different times. And I actually see that in articles where you get this entirely lengthy paragraph where they're saying one thing and all boils down to one sentence, but it takes them an entire paragraph to say it. And you just want to, like you said, go there and cut out every other word and just condense it. And people don't understand that it really takes a lot, willpower for me, to go through a paragraph like that and make sense of what are you saying? What do you mean? What does it amount to?
Absolutely. Well, two of the things that really catch my eye when I'm copy editing on Wikipedia and other places is that the confusion between your and your has just become endemic across the society, I think. A lot of people seem to have given up on trying to understand the difference between them. I had saw somebody on a internet forum once suggest that we should pronounce the words differently. That is to say, we should pronounce it your if we're talking about you are, and your if it's the possessive. But I just think it's important for us to recognize there is a difference there, and it matters. And if yeah, like what Oduit said about how we come across to the rest of the world is one of the reasons I think that's so important, especially with that split. And then the it's question, the basic thing I always say to my students, and sometimes I even make them chant it so that they might sink in, is that there is no apostrophe in the possessive it. If you're talking about the robot cutting off its arm, there is no apostrophe there.
I
So
often
and I'm
try to solve that problem on Wikipedia by telling people there shouldn't be contractions in their writing anyway.
Okay, why not? Tell us about why not, because that's come up before, and when I first got to Wikipedia, that kind of threw me. I'm like, what's wrong with contractions? Talk about that a little bit, what it.
It's pretty informal, and we try to have formal writing on Wikipedia, and so to have those contractions makes it look like you're writing the way you speak. Looks conversational. And so if you find yourself writing a contraction, you know that you're starting to write conversationally.
Sure.
And so you shouldn't even be using the its forms. You shouldn't even run into that problem, I always tell people. Of course, it would be nice if they knew the
Yeah,
difference.
right.
But
And I mean, that's one of the things I think too, is that Wikipedia has a house style. And of course, any place you're writing for is going to have a house style. But I think a lot of people come into the project thinking, well, I understand MLA style or APA or whatever it is. And I feel like, or they know some, their English classes have been very comprehensive and they feel like they have a really good, hold on the language. And they probably do. But when writing for Wikipedia, there's a certain way we're going to write. And it's important for us to orient
Well,
ourselves in that
there's
direction.
so many
So,
different things. One thing I
Phil,
would
did you
like to
have
say is
something
I
else
like
you
to
wanted to
see
mention?
text self-contained. Now, there's kind of a danger on Wikipedia that I notice all the time is to just say, well, I'll just put a wiki link, a blue link here, and I don't actually have to explain this obscure term. I can just put a blue link, and that'll be. Sometimes they even forget the blue link. They just say, well, here's this complicated phrase or term, which may have a separate article on it about it on Wikipedia, and they don't even bother to put a blue link in there or search for the appropriate blue link. And so the poor reader who's looking through it either is clicking just constantly to try to figure out what's going on, or it has to go and look up the blue link himself or look somewhere else. And really, I think most articles should be sort of self-contained, again, in the accessibility question. But if there is a Wikipedia article on that topic, it's nice to not only have it self-contained, but to have a so the person can look to get a little more information. After all,